KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. Jeff Rubin was a high-flying economist for a major Canadian investment bank until he decided to write a book about how high oil prices were going to flatten the global economy. That book was the bestseller, Why Your World is About to Get a Lot Smaller. Jeff Rubin's follow-up to that book is called The Big Flatline, Oil and the No-Growth Economy. And he joins us today from Toronto, Canada. Jeff, thanks for taking the time.
My pleasure, Ross.
You're not a big fan of the way that the U.S. government and others have been providing stimulus to try to jolt the economy back to life by government spending or by lowering interest rates. Why not?
Well, because I think it misdiagnoses the problem. I mean, what's holding back the U.S. economy, what's holding back the global economy is not the price of credit. So quantitative easing, holding interest rates at zero, really isn't what's going to leverage growth. And I think what we're finding is from these huge fiscal stimulus that yesterday's bailout is today's cutback. And we see that in places like Greece and Spain. And now we see the American economy perched on a fiscal cliff where it's going to have to pay for all this fiscal stimulus. So, I think when you step back and look at what's really holding back the economy, not just the U.S. economy, but the slowdown in Europe, the slowdown in China and India, it's really the cost of fuel.
Now, there are some flutters of revival in the U.S. economy. You don't think that's attributable to economic policies?
Well, the last ISM number for the manufacturing sector is just south of 50, which is suggesting another industrial contraction. I think when you step back and look at the extraordinary stimulus measures that have been taken, both on the monetary policy front and on the fiscal policy front, history speaks quite clearly about these kind of measures. They're unsustainable. And even with these measures, the U.S. economy over the last couple of years has been barely grown at around 2%.
I want to go back to long term in a moment, but short term, should we be worried about the fiscal cliff at the end of the year that would jack up taxes and cut government spending? Some economists say it's going to throw the economy back into a recession. What do you think?
I mean, it would, but I think the real fiscal cliff isn't some last-minute deal between Republicans and Democrats to get the appropriate balance between spending cuts and tax increases. The real fiscal cliff is when the People's Bank of China, which is the largest holder of U.S. Treasury bonds, decides that it's not going to finance the deficit anymore. And when that happens, I think that Washington's going to feel the pressures that Athens and Madrid have done, and they're going to be forced into fiscal action, and that fiscal action is unfortunately going to be a huge break on economic growth.
Well, there's certainly weakness in the U.S. economy, but where's China going to put all that money if not in the U.S.? Is there really an alternative for them?
Well, first of all, understand that the foreign reserves in the People's Bank of China isn't like your money looking for the highest rate of return. It can exactly go to another portfolio manager. The reason that the People's Bank of China has been buying U.S. treasuries has been to hold down the value of the yuan. But that really relates to a past epoch of economic growth in China where it's been to supplying Walmart stores. I think that's a rearview mirror. I think China's growth is more its domestic market and its regional trading partners. And if China doesn't have to be so concerned about holding down the yuan-U.S. dollar exchange rate, then China doesn't have to show up at the Treasury auction. And I would argue that's the real fiscal cliff that the American economy will ultimately have to face.
Economist Jeff Rubin is my guest. You can join in by giving me a call at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. Toll free 800-289-5869 or write to us, conversation@KUOW.org. As the title of your book, The Big Flatline, Oil and the No-Growth Economy, suggests, it's high energy prices that you see as really kind of being the big underlying issue that's going to drive us down. You think high energy prices are irreversible?
Well, I think that in many respects they are. That, you know, we're looking at Brent today, which is effectively the world oil price, trading at $110 a barrel. It's been there since January 2011. And, of course, it's not that the world's ever going to be running out of oil. The International Energy Agency has just come out with an outlook that says America may produce more than Saudi Arabia. But the real question is the price of the oil. I mean, it's not exactly like, you know, the U.S. oil consumers have been denied supply by an OPEC oil shock. It's been over three decades since there's been an OPEC oil shock. The real issue isn't where the oil's coming from. The real issue is the cost of getting it out of the ground. And whether we're talking about the Bakken shale oil or whether we're talking about bitumen from the oil sands in Alberta or the Orinoco heavy oil belt in Venezuela or deep water oil or oil in the Brazilian subsalt, the only problem is it takes triple-digit oil prices to make the extraction of these fuels viable.
Well, you argue that the solution to high energy prices, as you just said, isn't from finding more oil or from building nuclear plants or from renewable energy, from wind or solar. That's different than what I've been hearing from a lot of people. Why wouldn't wind energy or solar energy reduce the price of energy and be a solution to this problem?
Well, it's because of why we burn oil, and why we burn oil in North America, and indeed China as well, is basically as a transit fuel. I mean, we used to burn oil as a home heating fuel. I mean, there are certain spots in North America that still do, but as a continent as a whole, we don't. We've replaced it with natural gas. We don't burn oil to generate power. We've replaced it with much cheaper natural gas. We don't need oil to make petrochemicals. Again, we can use natural gas, but we do need oil as a transit fuel. And that's the problem, that no matter how we move goods around, whether it's by air, whether it's by boat, whether it's by truck or by train, we're burning some form of oil. And there's a reason for that, because oil packs so much energy density that solar or wind, while it may make some contribution to the grid right now, for it to trickle down to a transit fuel level is pretty minimal.
Well, we have automobiles now that are getting charged. Perhaps they could be charged sometime in the future by solar or wind energy, and those batteries propel them.
That's right. And there are also vehicles that run on natural gas or propane. But out of a vehicle stock of 240 million vehicles on the road in America, less than 1% don't run on oil. So I would argue that right now we got to focus more on the demand side than on the supply side. I mean, it's always inviting to believe that there's some supply side technological revolution around the corner that will wean our dependency off oil as a transit fuel. And maybe in the fullness of time that will happen. But right now, I think that the success of dealing with these triple-digit oil prices is to learn how to run your economy using less oil. And I think ultimately that's what triple-digit oil prices will dictate we all do.
Jeff Rubin's my guest. His new book is called The Big Flatline. And one of the countries that you profile here is Denmark, which many say is pointing the way for us in energy. They've cut their carbon dioxide emissions. They make 11% of their exports from the sales of energy technology. Wind power accounts for 20% of the domestic energy generation. But when you went there, you were kind of floored when you found out where the other 80% was coming from.
Right, because all of that turns out to be a total head fake. That you know, I mean, the other 80% of Denmark's power comes from coal, the dirtiest of all hydrocarbons. And that's the same percentage as China's grid would rely on coal. So the obvious question is, why has coal-fired China emissions surpassed the United States and coal-fired Denmark reduced their emissions below 1990 levels? And the answer to this riddle is that it doesn't matter whether your power in Copenhagen comes from wind or from coal. You pay via carbon taxes 30 cents per kilowatt hour. And I'd venture to say that's probably 3 to 4 times what people in Seattle would pay for power.
Yeah.
The good news is that, you know what? You don't have to be particularly suited for wind power. You charge 30 cents per kilowatt hour, and I'll guarantee you that electricity consumption will fall. And when electricity consumption falls, you won't have to combust nearly as much coal. Because on average, people in Copenhagen use 30% less power than people in Toronto. And that's all about the price of electricity.
Anybody who goes to Copenhagen notices all the people riding bicycles, really a well-developed bicycle lane system. And you say people are on those bikes in large part because they've just made it so expensive to buy cars.
That's right. And what you don't know is if you go buy a car with a V8 engine in it, you'll pay 180% surcharge on the price of that car. So you got to ask yourself, why is it that certain countries have these policies and other countries don't? Well, let me point out that the coal that doesn't get burnt because of 30 cent per kilowatt power prices comes from Germany. And when they slap 180% surcharge on the car, it's some auto worker in BMW or Audi in Germany who loses their job. Now, consider those policies where I live. I live in Ontario, which manufactures or assembles more cars than any province or state in the United States. The former mayor in Toronto wanted to levy a $65 ownership fee on each car. Needless to say, he got booted out of office. I mean, would Denmark have these policies if it had a huge coal industry or auto assembly industry? Probably not. But the fact is that necessity is the mother of invention. That if Danes and people in Japan can adapt and use a lot less energy, guess what? Folk in North America can too.
Well, in Denmark, one of the reasons they can raise the prices is because they don't have to deal with auto workers or big oil like we do and you do need to do in Canada. And I've noticed that politicians who want to raise taxes tend not to be particularly popular among the public. So how do prices get raised to the level they need to be in order to reduce this consumption, which you say is important to moving forward, when it's really difficult for a politician to do that?
Okay, and I think what's happening is that, you know, even countries that nature has blessed with significant hydrocarbon deposits like the United States and Canada, we're now finding that the kind of prices that we need to raise this oil out of the ground, whether it's shale oil out of the Bakken or Eagle Ford, or whether it's bitumen out of the tar sands in Alberta, those translate into the same prices that kill economic growth. So it's really the rising price of fuel that is going to force us to adapt like people in Copenhagen and people in Japan have adapted for the last several decades. Necessity forced them. The price of fuel will force us. We won't need any carbon taxes. I mean, you don't need to raise CAF standards when oil costs $5 a gallon. Motorists will figure out all by themselves what kind of cars to drive.
It sounds like you're a believer in the marketplace as eventually resolving this.
I am a believer in the marketplace. I've joined the WWF campaign to stop the Enbridge's pipeline to the Great Bear Rainforest in British Columbia. And what I've tried to convince environmentalists, and I don't know how successful I've been, is that the triple-digit oil prices is our friend, not our enemy. That triple-digit oil prices is going to lead to conservation, whether we want to or not. That triple-digit oil prices is going to change our carbon profile, whether we're willing to make those choices or not.
Jeff Rubin,
so I think that there's some silver linings here.
Jeff Rubin, economist, my guest, his new book called The Big Flatline. You've got an interesting chapter on expanding the Keystone Pipeline, which takes oil from Canada to ports in Texas, if it happens. President Obama put the Keystone Project on hold because of environmental concerns. And Jeff Rubin, you see this is having some unforeseen consequences. You call it the Keystone Conundrum. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, one thing that happened is the next thing, you know, all of a sudden, Trans-Canada Pipeline or Enbridge or Kinder Morgan all want to build pipelines through the last remaining temperate rainforest in British Columbia to get to the coast, because without getting to the coast, you can't expand oil sand production in Alberta, which is right now about 1.8 million barrels a day, in which the International Energy Agency says is going to double or triple. Well, it's not going to double or triple unless you get access to a coast and world markets. Ironically, environmental concerns that have led to Obama putting the kibosh on the Keystone XL expansion now put BC's rainforest at risk. The problem for Canada, of course, is that by not getting access to world oil markets, not only can the country not increase production, but it's getting a fraction of world oil prices because it's getting paid the price of oil in Cushing, Oklahoma, West Texas Intermediate, as opposed to world prices, which are Brent, and that's over $20 a barrel.
You're very downbeat about what governments have been trying to do. You mentioned you think some of these things will correct themselves in the marketplace. Is that to say that you're upbeat about our energy future, our economic future?
I'm downbeat about what governments are saying because, of course, we don't want to hear the kind of message that I'm delivering. I mean, Romney or Obama couldn't deliver a message by saying, look, folks, in a world of $100 a barrel oil, the largest oil-consuming economy can't grow at the same rate that it used to when it was $20 a barrel. We expect to be able to have our economy growing at the same rates it has in the last 20 to 30 years. And when we don't see that kind of economic performance, we put pressure on our politicians to step on the gas, whether that means flooding the system with money, quantitative easing, or having the U.S. Treasury spend that money through huge deficits like never before. But I think most Americans are beginning to recognize that neither zero interest rates or a $1 trillion budget deficit is really a substitute for cheap oil. And the sooner we do recognize it, maybe the more intelligent policy decisions we'll start to see.
Jeff Rubin, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Jeff Rubin joining us from Toronto. The Economist's new book is called The Big Flatline, Oil and the No-Growth Economy. David Hyde produces our show with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Cameron Drews, Joshua McNichols. Andy Hurst is our engineer. I'm Ross Reynolds. Finally today, we note the passing of jazz pianist, composer, American cultural ambassador Dave Brubeck. In the late 1950s, Brubeck observed a group of Turkish street musicians performing a folk song in 9/8 time, a very rare meter for Western music. That led to his composition, his signature composition, Take Five in 5/4 time.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.